Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's Friday, the 13th, but no Triska Decaphobia here. We carry on as usual. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable. Before you head into the weekend, your chance to get up to date on the big stories of the week with three top political reporters. Bombshell news yesterday, the House January 6th committee stunned Washington by issuing subpoenas to five Republicans in Congress, including Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, all five of whom had dismissed previous requests to testify voluntarily. They're certain to refuse, but when they do, will anything happen? In other news of the week, Donald Trump won a big primary in West Virginia, but lost a big one in Nebraska. He also learned that he's the target of an FBI investigation over classified documents that he took with him to Mar-a-Lago. On Wednesday, Senate Democrats staged a hopeless vote to codify Roe v. Wade. America marked the grim milestone of 1 million COVID deaths. And this week, Joe Biden came out swinging against what he called the ultra-MAGA party. A lot to dig into, so here today to help us make some sense of it all, Jeff Duffer, Editor-in-Chief, National Journal, Lauren Burke, newswriter, Black Press USA, and host of the Burke File podcast, and from the West Coast, Melanie Mason, National Political Correspondent of the LA Times. Hello to you all. Thanks for joining us. So, Jeff, this big issuing the subpoenas, an unusual move for a congressional investigation to subpoena sitting members of Congress. They're not going to testify. So why did the committee do this? What's it mean?
That's a good question. Apparently, there was a lot of hand-wringing over this. Liz Cheney was reportedly the primary driver of this and wanted to have no stone unturned, or at least no stone try to be unturned. As you said, they're never going to testify. I don't think there's going to be an actual price paid politically or legally for McCarthy and his cronies. They know they can just run the clock out because they think they're going to take the House over. And any attempt to enforce this in the meantime is going to trigger all kinds of litigation over congressional prerogatives, the speech and debate clause, et cetera, et cetera. But politically, I think this is a fascinating development because after trying to keep the Freedom Caucus at arm's length for years, really, McCarthy now finds himself in the exact same foxhole with them. There were five subpoenas issued. Four of them, Andy Biggs, Jim Jordan, Scott Perry, Mo Brooks, are all Freedom Caucus members. Perry is the current chair. Biggs and Jordan are are past chairs. The only one who isn't a Freedom Caucus member is McCarthy. So paradoxically, I think you'd think that this would hurt McCarthy's chances to become speaker, but no, I think it actually improves his chances to become speaker. He needs to lock down those Freedom Caucus votes, even if he loses a couple moderates in the process. There aren't that many moderates left. And if he's closing ranks with the Freedom Caucus, you'd have to think that that helps as far as solidarity goes.
So, Melanie, these subpoenas are really a prelude to the public hearings for this committee that are now scheduled to start June 9. Nationally televised hearings, January 6th. What kind of resonance does this still have across the country, are you finding? I mean, are people still interested? Is January 6th still, you know, front and center as an issue?
I think if you're out and you're talking to voters across the country, I think the short answer is no. I mean, there is so much news going on. And I think that the fundamentals, when you're talking about the economy, when you're talking about people's worried about public safety, about COVID resurging. But I do think individual developments have the possibility of captivating people's attention, at least for, you know, an evening, a couple minutes. And so I do think that the question for this committee is, are they able to, through these hearings, sort of lay out a narrative that builds on itself? And I think that Democrats and then the two Republicans who are on the committee, they need to be able to present something that's compelling. And my question is this drip, drip, drip of information, this feeling like they are building towards something, does it feel a little bit resonant to what was going on with the Mueller report a couple of years ago, where the expectations of some big bombshell might be outpacing what is actually discovered? So I think that the committee needs to grab people's attention and build upon it. But I do wonder about the expectations game that they may be setting up.
Right. And Lauren, there's always a question about like where they are heading and how high they are going to go. Related to this, I want to play a quick clip. So former Defense Secretary Mark Esper is out with a new book, right? And he appeared on Fox News this week with Brett Baer. And Brett asked him, I think, a pretty critical question that does relate to what the January 6th committee is looking into. Mark Esper.
Do you think Donald Trump was a threat to democracy?
I think that given the events of January 6th, given how he has undermined the election results, he incited people to come to D.C., stirred them up that morning and failed to call them off. To me, that threatens our democracy.
So, yes,
I think the answer would. What else can you conclude, Brett?
So, Lauren, is this where the committee is going to right after Donald Trump himself as a threat to democracy?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they have to broaden out the debate and talk about the attack on the U.S. Capitol and our democracy. I mean, if you can't market that, if the Democratic Party can't make that a compelling argument, and I get that our news cycles are very short. The attention spans are very short. Gas is almost at $5, so there's a lot of distractions. Everybody understands that. But the idea that this isn't compelling and that subpoenaing five members of Congress, you know, I guess I'm old here because I'm old enough to remember when Bill Jefferson's office was raided in 2006. We did have a debate over whether or not the executive branch could investigate the legislative branch. But once again, there's all sorts of elements to this. And, you know, the questions that we asked the members yesterday, Benny Thompson, Raskin, everybody, was basically when they ignore the subpoena, you know, what is going to happen? What are you going to do? And of course, the House members are stuck on, well, maybe we'll go through the Ethics Committee, maybe we'll go to contempt. But really, none of the members of the January 6th committee wanted to answer that question. Benny Thompson really didn't want to answer that question. It's generally understood that these subpoenas are going to be ignored. But at the same time, it's generally understood that there are other things that can happen that could, you know, escalate it further, possibly. Including the DOJ doing something. But really, I mean, everybody knows that it's 180 days to election day. They are running out of time. The other big question they were asked was, look, if you do these types of things, subpoenaing these members, wouldn't you expect that the Republicans are going to do the same to the Democrats next year, which is another thing sitting out there. So I don't know. I do think that if you can't have hearings, live hearings that can't make this compelling, I'm not sure what else has to happen.
Yeah. So, Jeff, in the meantime, the FBI, we learned yesterday that the FBI is yet another investigation of Donald Trump. These documents that he took down to Mar-a-Lago with him, and then the National Archives got them back, and now the FBI is investigating these. What's this all about? What are these documents, and why are they so important?
In my mind, we don't know what this is, what these documents are necessarily all about. But in my mind, the one antecedent I keep thinking about is Sandy Berger, of course, the Clinton NSC director who was caught spiriting some documents out of the National Archives, and he got the nickname Sandy Burglar. This is not quite as cut and dried. I think Trump does have some more plausible deniability than that. He said, well, somebody had packed some stuff up, and among the things they were packing up was this tranche of documents that turned out to be classified. Sorry, we gave them back. But I'm just also blown away at the legal exposure that an ex-president faces. Typically, an ex-president gets out of the White House and faces zero legal exposure. Now we've got this. We've got his property in Westchester. I can't even keep track of it all. There's multiple fronts of legal exposure that he's got. And I think this, if he wants to run in 2024, which he seems to want to do, he's going to have to get some of this stuff in his rearview mirror, I would think. He says he doesn't, he said in the past he doesn't want to settle, but he always settles. He settled Trump University. He settled the charity stuff.
Right.
He just settled with DC over the Trump Hotel, which during inauguration, which now no longer has his name on it. So in some way, shape, or form, he has to get some of this stuff in his rearview mirror if he's going to run.
Yeah. We've also never seen a former president, you say, so exposed on the legal front. We've never seen one so active on the political front. And we saw that. We've seen that now in Republican primary after Republican primary, endorsing candidates right and left for Senate, for governor, for House, for dog catcher. I don't know. Melanie, how's he doing?
Well, so far, his record, which I do think is a metric that's very important to him, is quite good, both because he has sort of stacked his early endorsements with ringers, right? Folks who are in deep red districts who are clearly going to win their primaries, but also because he has shown some political heft, like the Ohio Senate race, where he really did propel J.D. Vance to victory. And so what we saw in this last round of primaries is that he did well in West Virginia and winning a congressional race. But in Nebraska, for example, his gubernatorial candidate, who has been racked with lots of scandal in himself, did not get over the finish line. So sort of a mixed decision there. But I do think that this is how Trump continues to keep himself relevant in the news cycle. I get those press releases every day of endorsements that range from, as you said, governor or Senate to literally Miami-Dade County executive. I mean, it really is as granular as you can get. And what that does is it injects him into every storyline for every primary. And in some sense, the record matters, but I also think just the conversation is something that I think continues to benefit somebody who desperately wants to still be seen as the center of the political universe.
Lauren, are we exaggerating maybe Trump's importance? Now, Melanie mentioned J.D. Vance. He did win the primary in Ohio with 32% of the vote. 68% of Republicans in Ohio voted for someone Donald Trump did not endorse. I mean, they were conservative. They were Trumpers, right? But they were not Trump's guy.
Right. It seems to be a little bit all over the place. Yes, the West Virginia candidate won by a lot. Alex Mooney was 54%. Then I think about last year in Virginia, how Glenn Youngkin kept Trump out of the Commonwealth of Virginia and won. And of course, you do have the J.D. Vance example. Trump won that. But, you know, what I think may answer our question is the Pennsylvania situation.
Yeah,
you know, he has endorsed Dr. Oz, and Oz is up in the polls. Interestingly, you have a surging Black Republican female candidate, but I don't know that she's going to surge past, you know, up to the top. That may answer the question, but it does seem like if you did a scorecard, it would be a little bit all over the place. You know, Trump wins some, and sometimes he loses some.
So, Jeff, what's your read on Pennsylvania? It's up. This is next Tuesday. It's going to be the next contest. Yeah, Mehmet Oz, who I don't know, seems to me to be kind of nuts, but he is leading with Trump's endorsement, and a lot of Republicans are saying that was a big mistake. And as Lauren pointed out, suddenly there's this Kathy Barnett who is, you know, really climbing up in the polls, and everybody says she would be the worst possible candidate for Republicans to run based on some of her previous statements about gays and Muslims and Barack Obama and everything else. What's going on?
Everyone thought Ohio was really the main event in terms of Republican and Republican primaries, but I think this one eclipses it. You've got a really close race, and you've got three candidates who can each lay a different yet credible claim to the MAGA flag. You've got Oz, who's got the actual Trump endorsement. You've got McCormick, who is surrounded by ex-Trump staffers.
Right.
And then you've got Barnett, who is arguably the most Trumpy of all of them. the one thing she didn't have was money, but I just read this morning that Susan B. Anthony list just announced this morning they're spending $2.3 million on her behalf on ads. Partly because Barnett makes abortion such a central part of her pitch. She says that she was the product of a rape, and that because her mother did not terminate that pregnancy, she's here today. So she's very much carrying that flag, especially as the only woman in the race. So meanwhile, she really benefits from Oz and McCormick going scorched earth on each other. Millions and millions of ads just beating each other up for the last 2 or 3 months. And that was really created a vacuum for Barnett to step in. Is she going to win? It's hard to say. But regardless of what happens, I expect the final tally to be very, very splintered. I don't think anybody's going to come close to 50%.
And that's May 17th, but there are a series of Republican primaries here. And we'll see how they all play out and where Donald Trump ends up at the end of it with his scorecard, which we will all be watching. Jeff, you mentioned the word abortion. That's the issue, key issue in Pennsylvania and still a key issue in Washington based on the big leak from the Supreme Court, Justice Alito's draft opinion to overturn Roe v. Wade. That still dominates the news in Washington. Let's jump into that. But first, a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod. Then we'll be back with today's panel, Jeff Dufour from National Journal, Lauren Burke from Black Press USA, Melanie Mason from the Los Angeles Times. And today's roundtable on the Bill Press Pod brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the great men and women of the Teamsters Union, 1.5 million members strong, the largest and most diverse of all of America's labor unions, now under the new leadership of General President Sean O'Brien. They represent just about every sector of American workers, from vegetable workers in California, construction workers in Las Vegas, brewery workers in St. Louis, to bakery workers in Maine. As they say, they represent everybody from A to Z, everybody from airline pilots to zookeepers. We salute the members of the Teamsters Union, thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod, and direct you to their website at teamster.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with today's roundtable. Melanie Mason joining us from the LA Times, Lauren Burke, Black Press USA, and her own Burke File podcast, and Jeff Dufour from National Journal. Protests continue in Washington and cities around the country about the pending decision of the Supreme Court, judging by a leaked draft opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, that the Supreme Court will in fact overturn Roe v. Wade. The Senate Democrats staged a vote this week in the Senate, of course, to codify Roe v. Wade. They couldn't even get past the filibuster. That effort failed 51-49. Knowing they couldn't make it, Lauren, why did they do this? Was it a waste of their time?
I don't know that it was a complete waste of their time. I think they did want a message. Obviously, they wanted a message around it, but the message was not particularly strong. And of course, the vote was a losing one, and it makes, you know, forces people, of course, to have to talk about the filibuster, which Senator Elizabeth Warren was stomping around talking about a little bit, but it still, you know, hasn't gotten to the point where they sound like they're going to actually change anything. You know, it would be interesting if the Democratic Party had some sort of sense of political strategy on these things. They, of course, had the Vice President Kamala Harris come up and sit in the chair, and then she made a statement, you know, after the vote, and Patty Murray and Senator Schumer made a statement. But one would think that, you know, they might do this in a more piecemeal way, even if it was just a filibuster vote, you know, bringing up things like the rape incest exception with regard to abortion, make people take a vote on that, making Manchin take that vote. Now, I know that Manchin is pro-life and it's probably not going to change anything, but I just think that Democratic messaging, as usual, is not as strong as it could be, given what we see in the polls on the abortion issue.
Right.
So I guess the answer to your question is that that probably was not a good use of time. We'll see what they do next.
It was definitely intended as a message vote, right, to get the message out that one party is pro-choice, the other party clearly is not. Make no mistake about it. In terms of messaging, Melanie from the West Coast, we heard a familiar voice sort of echoing some of the things that Lauren said about, come on, guys, where are you? Get your act together. Here is Governor Gavin Newsom.
Where is the Democratic Party? Where's the party? Why aren't we calling this out? This is a concerted, coordinated effort. And yes, they're winning. We need to stand up. Where's the counteroffensive?
Melanie, what's Gavin's plan?
Well, in some ways, this is a perfect issue for Newsom to seize on. You know, he's running for re-election for governor, and he's in great shape. He has a ton of money. He has sort of nominal Republican opposition. He won very handily last year in this recall effort. But at the same time, I think that he was flailing a little bit to figure out what his re-election message was, because the truth is that mood out here in California is incredibly pessimistic. Our voters, according to our polls, see the state and the country going in the wrong direction. And so this gives Newsom something to run against, because his Republican opponent really isn't sort of quite the sparring partner that he would need. And so he gets to run against the dismantling of Roe v. Wade. And I also think he gets to distance himself a bit from the National Republican Party, Democratic Party, which people, I think, are feeling a little bit disillusioned with because of this lack of coordinated plan. I mean, we know that there has been a 40-year effort to have Roe v. Wade overturned. The fact that Democrats seem to be so baffled by their messaging, I think that Newsom is happy to put a little distance. And the other thing is that it's a way for him to seize not just the California statewide news cycle, but the national news cycle. And of course, this is somebody who we're always wondering if he is keeping his eye on higher office. So I think that for Newsom, he clearly saw this as a natural issue for him to step into.
Does he also see California as a sanctuary state, basically, on this issue?
Yes. And in fact, his new budget.
He's talked about that, I believe.
He has. And his new budget will actually include funds that would pay for out-of-state women to get the procedure done here in California. It would help sort of essentially make the state this safe haven. Of course, that budget would have to be approved by lawmakers. But I think that California, in its state constitution, has the right of to privacy already written in, which has been interpreted by the courts as an explicitly abortion protection by our state courts. Mm-hmm. He still would like to have even more explicitly a constitutional amendment saying, we really mean it, abortion is legal in this state. That also is another way to get Democratic voters out to the polls in November, because that is something that the voters would have to approve. But I think that he, again, is both sending a message to the pro-abortion rights people in the state that here's something to rally around, and those across the country who are looking for some sort of national leader on this, that he feels he can step into this role and he can use the California budget, California law, as a way to do that.
So, Jeff, how do you rank or rate this as its impact on the national political scene? You know, almost everybody agreed that this is a grim prospects for Democrats in the midterms. Is this the issue that could turn the midterms around?
I wouldn't say that just yet. I think regardless of what happens on the abortion issue, I think the House is pretty much gone for Democrats. A few races around the margins, sure. The Senate's another matter. I think the Senate is going to be much closer. I think best case scenario for Democrats is they can hold on, at least get their 50-seat majority. Best case in the House, I think they still lose 10. But this is undoubtedly a motivator. And Democrats were going to have a turnout problem this election. They've typically had problems with turnout in midterm elections. Republican turnout has historically been better. And a lot of Democrats had been disillusioned, depressed with how things have gone and how little in their mind Biden has been able to deliver. This is an issue that really injects a real unknown. And I think it does have the potential to really skyrocket turnout and enthusiasm and money. The pro-choice groups have taken in millions and millions of dollars since this news broke a week and a half ago.
Right. And Lauren, you alluded to this a little earlier. This also has a potential for boosting the standing and, I guess, presence of Kamala Harris, right?
It does. It does if she can get her act together with regard to communication strategy, which I think writ large in the Democratic Party is a problem. You know, it is a sort of there's an assumption here because we're so many of us are on the East Coast that the abortion issue is, a top one or two issue. But, you know, when you poll people, the top one or two is something around the economy. You know, we're dealing with a situation here where baby formula is running out and gas prices and inflation are a problem. And abortion is usually sort of 8, 9, 10. And of course, the reason we talk about it so much is because Planned Parenthood dominates politics on the Democratic side as far as money and influence. And so it gets, an outsized part of the political conversation. So I'm not a big believer in the abortion issue being the thing that, you know, turns everything around. It certainly is getting headlines, and I see that. We obviously all see the demonstrations at the houses and the homes of members of the U.S. Supreme Court. But when people go into the voting booth, they typically are in there thinking about more bread and butter issues and education and money in their pocket. So it's something that I think certainly the vice president could gain some advantage on, but has not yet. We're all aware of the staff turnover going on with the vice president and really with the Biden administration in general. I think that's impacting her. But we'll have to see whether or not she can turn it into something that's a political advantage.
So, Melanie, Lauren mentions the protests at some of the justices' homes. Republicans in the Congress are demanding, first of all, Chief Justice Roberts is demanding that there be an investigation into the leak. Republicans in Congress are demanding that there be an investigation and a crackdown on any protests at any of the justices' home. Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, part of the Democratic leadership this week, said maybe they ought to be investigating something else. Here's Congressman Jeffries.
If Justice Thomas really wants to deal with this problem of people supposedly unwilling to accept outcomes that they don't like, I've got some advice for Justice Thomas. Start in your own home. Have a conversation with Jeannie Thomas. She refused to accept the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election. Why? Because she didn't like the outcome.
So, Jeff, also on the political front this week, President Biden, speaking out more than he has, at any rate, in the past, about the Republican Party. I remember, he ran for election saying, "I'm the guy that can work with Republicans. This is going to be a new day. We're all going to work together." And he's sort of been keeping that trend for the last couple of years. That suddenly is changing. Here's just one example of the president this week talking about the ultra MAGA party.
Americans have a choice right now between two paths reflecting two very different sets of values. My plan attacks inflation and grows the economy by lowering costs for working families, giving workers well-deserved raises, reducing the deficit by historic levels, and making big corporations and the very wealthiest Americans pay their fair share. The other path is the ultra-MAGA plan to raise taxes on working families, lower the income of American workers, threaten sacred programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and give break after break to big corporations and billionaires.
Ultra MAGA party, Jeff. This is a new term. Does it ring?
I like the tagline. I'm not sure if it's going to get legs, but I understand why he's given this the old college try. He's also seizing on, when he's talking about the ultra MAGA party raising taxes, he's of course seizing on Rick Scott's 11-point plan, or was it 13-point plan, something like that. which Mitch McConnell immediately disavowed, but Democrats are trying to make hay with this throughout the country. Rick Scott said he wanted to tax every American, that every American should pay some level of taxes. I don't blame Biden for doing this. He has to do this because there's two kinds of elections. There's a referendum election and there's a choice election. The midterm election is almost always a referendum on the incumbent president and his party, especially when they have unified government like they do. And he's trying desperately to make this a choice election between what we offer and what the other guys offer. I'm skeptical that he can do that because, to Lauren's point, the economic numbers, the economic situation is not in his favor. It's probably not going to be in his favor 6 months hence. But he's got to try.
But it seems like this is a theme, right, that he's saying that Democrats ought to be running on, is to build up the fear of what could happen on almost every level were Republicans to take back control of the Congress. Isn't that his ultimate motive, Lauren?
Yeah, it is. You know, I think about last year in Virginia and that not working. Mm-hmm. See, these things are great in terms of the reality that we know. We saw what happened last year at the Capitol. We saw what happened with the presidency of Donald Trump. We see a party that is effectively chipping away at institutions and democracy. But you still have to market that. You still have to have a communication strategy that makes people feel some fear about that. And we live in an age of misinformation and disinformation. People are greatly influenced by that. The democratization of technology has allowed anybody to get on a platform and put information out on a very grand scale, and it is working. And Joe Biden, I think a very well-intentioned person, to say the least, but he still tends to think that this is the politics in the Senate of 1973 when he entered. And, you know, I can remember him once again making some statement about how back in the days when I was, you know, first here, we used to work and sit down with segregationalists and play poker with them. And of course, when he entered the Senate, John Stennis was there, James Eastland was there, Jesse Helms was there. I understand what he's saying, but at some point somebody on the Democratic side has to realize what time we live in. And it would be probably beneficial for the democracy of the United States if that person was Joe Biden or Merrick Garland. So far, we haven't seen much to evidence that they know what time it is. And so when history gives you these moments, people have to step up to that moment. We really haven't seen that, quite frankly, from this White House.
So, Melanie, we have so far, talked about a lot of issues, but maybe we have buried the lead. The biggest story of the week, Elon Musk saying he will let Donald Trump back on Twitter. Is this good for America?
Well, I think that is this good for America? I think that that's still very much TBD. To be totally honest, it's still very much TBD if Elon Musk is actually going to acquire Twitter. I mean, I think that that is kind of the craziest sort of part of this news cycle, is that we're watching this tech magnate both make this play, but then sort of also say, but you know, it's not a done deal yet. And so I think that as we are all thrown into a tizzy, myself and my news organization included, every time Musk makes these pronouncements, I think we all need to keep in mind that the ink is not dried on this deal yet. But that being said, I do think that there was a reason why Trump was taken off of this platform and Facebook. And that was because there was a genuine fear after January 6th that he was using these platforms for incitement. I think that what there has since been, I think, some real sort of heart, garment rendering among tech executives about this idea of this permanent ban, if that was the right way to go. Musk said that by permanently banning him, they actually gave Donald Trump more of a platform. I don't actually think that that's true. I do think that we have seen without Twitter, Trump has lost a lot of that immediacy that he so liked about being able to dominate the news cycle. I will tell you that was a pronouncement that was ironically cheered by Democrats, because as they are trying to have this sort of ultra MAGA branding, the fact that you have Trump probably potentially spouting off over any old thing and then making those Republican candidates respond to those tweets, I think Democrats would very much like for him to be in the news cycle as part of the strategy.
Right. And just a footnote on what you mentioned about the uncertainty of Elon Musk's plans. At 5:44 a.m. this morning, Elon Musk tweeted out to his 9 million followers that he was putting the Twitter deal on hold. And just about an hour later, he told the Wall Street Journal, no, he still wanted to buy Twitter. So who the hell knows, right, what's going to happen on that front? Hey, Jeff, we'll let you comment on the biggest story of the week of all. Again, we buried the lead. There is no longer any Trump hotel in Washington, D.C. What are we going to do for fun and nightlife now, Jeff, in Washington, you know?
I don't know where I'm going to get a $50 martini. I have to find a new home for a $50 martini. I have $50 burning a hole in my pocket. This is the end of a sordid saga, which isn't just 5 years old. It goes back really 10 years. I think the original sin here was the GSA way before Trump ever announced running for president. The original sin was the GSA ever granting the Trump organization this lease. Of course, it became a huge political issue and a conflict of interest issue. But at the time, I did reporting on this way back when. The rival groups that were bidding for this were very clear in their communications to the GSA that Trump was not a to be trusted as a business partner, that his business history gave all sorts of red flags. And of course, you know, they were right. So I think that's it's a cautionary tale for GSA, regardless of the political consequences.
I just want to point out that the new hotel will be a Waldorf Astoria hotel. So Jeff, there will be another location for you to get the $50 martini.
Especially with inflation, who knows? It would be 60 before too long.
And the $100 burger at the bar. All right. With that, we'll wrap up the news of the week. And a big thank you to Jeff Dufour and to Lauren Burke and to Melanie Mason. But don't run away yet. There's always one story we say with covering so much that stops us in our tracks and says, well, that's interesting, or that's sad, or that's funny. We call it our favorite story of the week. Lauren Burke, start us off. What caught your attention?
The Atlantic. As usual, The Atlantic gets me again. A story by Laura Bazin. Bazelon, sorry about that. How the ACLU lost its way. It gets into how the ACLU went from being an organization that, you know, stood for freedom of speech, no matter who was saying it, and due process, no matter what happened or what someone was accused of, to effectively another political organization. And the backdrop of this particular example deals with the case of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, the defamation case where we have Johnny Depp suing Amber Heard for $50 million, and then finding out that the editorial that is at the center of that case was written by the ACLU. And that was uncovered because of a December 2021 deposition of the ACLU's general counsel, which of course has been played all over the place. And we find out what the internal process is at the Washington Post with their editorial, with that particular editorial. And I thought this was a very interesting piece on a lot of fronts, not just about the ACLU, but about the Washington Post. So I picked that story.
Interesting and a sad commentary, too, on the ACLU. How about you, Jeff? What was your favorite story of the week?
Well, we talked earlier about the far right and how Republican leadership and more mainstream members need to get along with them in the House. And this is hard to do when Marjorie Taylor Greene is in the mix. Congressman Dan Crenshaw, who is no shrinking violet and no one's idea of a rhino Republican, got into it with MTG on Twitter this week. Crenshaw said, investing in the destruction of our adversary's military, i.e. Russia, without losing a single American troop, strikes me as a good idea. And Marjorie Taylor Greene piped in, so you think we're funding a proxy war with Russia? How does that help Americans? How does any of this help? And Crenshaw came back with, still going after that slot on Russia Today, huh?
RTTV.
Yeah, exactly. MTG TV, Moscow Bureau. So this is, you know, this is a dynamic which has yet to write its final act in the Republican conference. Remember, there was a relatively anodyne vote over support for Ukraine a couple weeks back, and a couple dozen Republicans voted against support for Ukraine on the floor. And this is, you know, we could call them the Russia caucus or what have you. But these internecine fights are not going to go away anytime soon. This is not over.
Yeah, but they're fun to watch.
They are fun to watch
for the rest of us. And Melody, there may be different stories on the West Coast that we're not aware of here. But how about you? What was your what caught your attention? It looks like we lost Melanie Mason from the West Coast. We'll catch up with her another time and get her favorite story the next time. But meanwhile, my favorite story of the week came during the Senate debate over abortion this week, thanks to Senator Steve Daines from Montana. You know, often people say dumb things on the floor, even United States senators. I could not believe this one. Steve Daines showed up to make the case for overturning Roe v. Wade, and he brought with him some great big visual aids about sea turtles. And the point that he made was, look at this, how off-base we are. We have laws that protect sea turtles, protect the eggs of sea turtles. Therefore, of course, following his logic, we should ban abortion. Hello? I mean, nobody could follow. It's not only a non sequitur. I think Senator Daines actually gets it backwards. We may, and as environmentalists, want to protect sea turtles, but no environmentalist has ever suggested that we force sea turtles to give birth, which is exactly what the Republicans want to do to American women. I just thought that was such an absurd argument to bring to the Senate floor. I used to think that Tommy Tuberville from Alabama was the dumbest United States senator. I now give that title to Steve Daines of Montana. And with that, we thank our panelists. We thank Jeff Duffer from the National Journal, Lauren Burke, Black Press USA, and the Burke File podcast. And we thank Melanie Mason, too, from the Los Angeles Times. Plus, we thank all of you for listening. Now, we're into the weekend. Enjoy your weekend. Have a great one. But come back and see us next Tuesday for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.